Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining us for the Kopernik Global Investors Quarterly Update. On today's call, we have David Ivan, Founder, Chief Investment Officer, and Lead Portfolio Manager, to discuss Kopernik's views on the current market environment and the portfolio positioning of its global all-cap strategy. Please note this call is being recorded, and the topics on this call are for informational purposes only and should not be regarded as a recommendation or an offer to buy or sell any product or service to which this information may relate. Certain products or services may not be available to all entities or persons. Please consider all risks carefully before investing. All participants will initially be in a listen-only mode. Following Mr. Ivan's discussion, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To ask a question, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference call over to David Ivan.
Okay, thank you, and good afternoon to everybody. Welcome to our first-ever quarterly call for Kopernik Global Investors. As you know, we started middle of last year and started raising assets generally at the beginning of November, and we're happy to report that we're now up to $600 million under management. We have 31 employees of the firm, and we are 100% employee-owned, and most of the employees do own shares in the firm. Many of you have known us over the years, so I don't need to go over the philosophy and process, which you fully understand. But I'll quickly say that, you know, because it's our view that the market is not fully efficient and that from time to time we can find mistakes that the market's making, that the best way to do that is to have the largest opportunity set available. Because of that, we prefer global and we prefer all cap. We like the ability to look for market mistakes across all countries, all regions, and all market capitalizations. And because of that, global public equities is all we do. We do have the long-only and long-short version of that. We do believe we got the timing perfect for, I think, active management, in particular for our style of management. The market is not fully efficient, but it's varying degrees of efficiency at various times, and sometimes, like 1980, 81, 82, everything's cheap, and that's good for everybody. Times like 2007, when everything's expensive, it's a tough time for all of us. But as active managers, times like 1972, times like 1999, and times like right now, when the market is extremely bifurcated, that's really the best thing for active managers. Quickly on 1972, they had what was known as the Nifty 50. A lot of stocks were falling sharply, but the stocks of really good, well-known companies, the Johnson & Johnsons and Avon's and Polaroids and Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, they went up and up and up, and people started to view them as safe. But hindsight showed that expensive doesn't prove to be safe, even if it is stable. And they had quite a fall, even as other parts of the market were starting to do well. Many of you will remember 1999, when small stocks, value stocks were falling, bricks and mortar stocks were falling, things were becoming really cheap. Even as tech and media and telecom and certain index stocks became very, very expensive. And that was a good opportunity to buy the smaller bricks and mortars and industrials. And it created an opportunity to make meaningful money, even as the NASDAQ was coming down. Now, who knows what the future will do, but this market feels a whole lot like those two markets. The market's bifurcated. It is paying way too much for certain stocks, and it is at the same time giving away a lot of stocks around the world at extremely attractive prices, which has us pretty excited. I can give lots of examples, but in general, many of them fall into two categories. One is the consumer, and the other is really volatility and whether volatility is risk, and we'll come back to that. But let's start with the consumer. Like with everything else, we like to have a view of what we think normal times look like. And we watch with interest as the market goes from one extreme to another extreme. And the aftermath of the 07, 08, 09 meltdown, it was interesting how people were shaking their heads at how consumer stocks in the U.S. ever got so expensive in 07. Did we really believe that a heavily indebted consumer would keep spending money forever? And how did the stocks get that expensive? And it could never happen again. At the same time, people were getting increasingly excited about the concept of a new emerging middle class, the hundreds of millions of people around the world that had gone from subsistence living to making $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a year, and all of a sudden were able to meet basic needs to pay for heating and cell phone service and electricity and those sort of things, and the market reflected those views. How interesting to watch the last two or three years where U.S. consumer stocks have had a run that leaves the highs of 2007 way down in the dust. Consumer stocks in the U.S. And somewhat Europe are becoming very, very expensive. And people no longer like that emerging consumer. The stocks that meet the basic needs of the growing population are being given away. So that in general, that's a concept that's very interesting to us. In specific, just like 1972, we have no problem with the companies. We think that Under Armour is a great company. We think 100 times earnings for clothing is a bit rich. We think Chipotle is a good company. We think 55 times earnings and 13 times book value is a lot for Mexican food, over which there are no barriers. At the same time, the market's paying prices like that. The formerly very expensive stocks of the growth areas of the world are pretty cheap. So we can own the dominant cell phone provider in China for 9 times earnings, and 9 times versus 100 times for an underarm. We are able to buy companies that provide electricity, and not just electricity, but from hydroelectric power that's cheap, that's clean, that has no CO2, and buy those franchises for a fifth of book value. Or maybe a tenth of what it would cost to replace these franchises. Things like that are very interesting. To be buying commuter rail services in China for less than book value is a fascinating thing to us. And so we're buying companies in the emerging markets that provide natural gas, that provide banking services, that provide electricity, that provide fuel, that provide pork and chicken and grains and those sort of things. Very, very interesting. And then growth companies at cheap, cheap prices. The other thing is, what is risk? People used to think that tracking error was a risk. Some still do. Tracking error, that tracks as an index. Indexes are sometimes risky, sometimes aren't, and not something that's ever been of much concern to us. Volatility is the new thing. People seem very concerned about volatility. We think volatility is not risk. But more specifically, for people that aren't long-term, volatility is risky. People should not invest unless they have a long-term time horizon, in our opinion. Volatility is risky if one is heavily in debt. We haven't been buying on margin, don't intend to. So with a long-term time horizon, one can not focus on volatility and start focusing on the prospects of permanent loss of capital or permanent loss of purchasing power. Those are the risks we're concerned with. And risk of losing money permanently has more with buying companies you don't understand, or paying too much for things, or putting all eggs in one basket, and we spend a lot of time trying not to do that. Focusing in on cost and price valuation, paying too much money is risky, even if it's good companies, as the Nifty 50 taught us all. And paying too little for things tend to lead to profits rather than losses. Examples would be various times after the junk bond market has crashed, people were able to make money because they weren't so risky at very, very cheap prices. So what seems to have been happening the last couple of years is these central banks ran the price of bonds to very, very high prices, and now people are starting that rotation out of bonds into other asset classes. So art's done well, collectibles done well, stocks are starting to do well. But mostly the nifty-50 type stocks, brand name stocks, mature stocks, companies that are big, slow-growing, well-known. And we think that they've run up to levels that they will prove to be risky, even though they're not volatile. People being afraid of volatility are avoiding volatile stocks, which is causing many of them to have fallen to really cheap prices, and history and logic would suggest that really cheap prices will make them less risky than the volatile part. And the examples include a lot of things. Start with emerging markets. We already talked about the consumer in emerging markets, but just across the board in emerging markets, people used to think the emerging markets would grow a lot faster than the developed world, and they have and will, but not to the extent people were looking for. So the markets went from priced at a premium to the developed world to priced at a huge discount. All right, should they have been at such a premium? Maybe not, but should they be at a big discount to the parts of the world that are mature and aren't going to grow? Probably not. So like buying the fast-growing parts of the world. We like growth without having to pay for growth. That's really nirvana when you can do that. And so is where we didn't have very much in the BRICS in particular a few years back. We're finding value in China. We're finding value in Brazil. We're finding incredible value in Russia and places that people don't like. They're afraid of volatility. They're afraid of headline risk. And we're happy to buy companies that meet basic needs. We're happy to buy companies that have oligopoly or monopoly status, that have what it takes to continue to make good returns. We're happy to buy companies that are trading a half of what they're worth, a quarter of what they're worth, and sometimes less than 10% of what they're worth. So we think volatility will prove to be opportunity, the chance to buy something that's fallen to a low price and prove not to be risk. And an example that happened in the last month or so that I find very interesting is this with Saddle Pea Court, I think they call it, this couple in California that stumbled onto these gold coins that had been buried back in 1896, I think. And I look at that. If somebody had gold coins back then, or if they had the Dow Jones Industrial back then, or anything like that, they would have watched wild price swings for the next 115 years. Wild price swings, lots of volatility. If instead they'd sold the gold coins and put it into cash, they would have $30,000 worth of cash. Nobody would be reading about somebody having found $30,000 worth of cash. But invested in gold, that $30,000 became worth more than $2 million. With the collector value, became worth $10 million. If they'd invested it in the Dow Jones, it would also be worth more than a few million dollars. So over the long term, volatile stocks and volatile gold prove to be good stores of value and actually creators of wealth. And stable cash lost 99% of its purchasing power. Now we have a Federal Reserve that is intent to make the purchasing power drop. We think stocks over the next 10 or 20 years should do a lot better than cash. And we think cheap stocks of growing businesses should do a lot better than other stocks. Hence, emerging markets are pretty exciting. Also, uranium mining stocks and gold mining stocks, where they have been hit so hard in the last couple of years, where we can buy them at a big discount to any reasonable value, liquidation value. Extremely attractive, but volatile. And that's a quick overview. There's a lot of examples. We've got what we think is a really good portfolio around the world. But I will stop here and happy to entertain questions.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, that is star one on your touchtone telephone. Again, that's star one to ask a question. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off so that your signal can reach our equipment. Once again, please press star one if you would like to ask a question. Our first question will come from Jerry Klein with Merrill Lynch.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Good, thanks. Your thoughts on the recent events in Russia, and could you break down your current Russian holdings?
Certainly. I think, like a lot of things, like Fukushima 2-3 years back, it was a horrible thing. It was bad. We wish it hadn't happened. As investors, we were very happy to buy some good railroads at a cheap price and good banks and good brokers and things at a cheap price. What's happening in Russia and Ukraine specifically, we wish it hadn't happened. It's unfortunate. But just like with other times in the past, people are they're making decisions based on their emotions, I think, rather than based on economics. The problems in Russia are there. We don't dispute that. We would like to see change there. However, you have a country that runs a trade surplus. You have a country that's a fairly balanced budget. A country that has debt of only 37% to GDP, a growing country, a country that has lots of natural gas that is close to Europe and the infrastructure to get it there. They have forests, they have ag land, they have hydroelectric power. So our view is not to say that Russia is good, and it's not to say that Russia is bad. It is an incredible country with a lot of great things, with a lot of problems and a lot of things that we wish for change. So when you add it all up, have decided we want half price on anything we buy in Russia. If it's not more than half price, we're not interested. We are getting things down 80%, down 90%, unbelievable values to find a company like Gazprom trading at 2.5 times earnings. Or to put it even further into perspective, if you look at the enterprise value of a company divided by the amount of barrels of oil equivalent they have, if you look at Total, Chevron, Exxon, Shell, they tend to be $15 to $20 per barrel. And this one's at $1 per barrel, $1. So a very, very cheap company. This is a company that pays a 6% dividend and still grows book value every year. So you read about the problems that are true, but they are growing with book value. They are creating wealth. So definitely one of our bigger holdings has been Gazprom, one of the better gas companies in the world. We own the stock exchange there. That's doing pretty well. We own Sberbank, which is far and away the dominant bank with a good balance sheet and in a country that, as I mentioned, doesn't have very much debt. So whereas a lot of the rest of us around the world are trying to figure out how do we pay down our debt, here's a country that could grow debt. There's chance for growth. So the dominant bank in Russia, we have a little drug distribution company. It's growing. It's doing pretty well. It's selling at about a tenth of what it would cost for similar companies in the U.S. And we have a generator of hydroelectric power, and we also have a distributor of electricity. So you cross different sectors at prices that we view as 80-plus percent discounts to what they're worth. Think with difficulties comes opportunity, and this is opportunity in the extreme.
Thank you. We'll take our next question from Brian Mackey with Advisor Investments. Please go ahead.
Hi, David. Thank you for taking the call today. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the work you do understanding the individual companies, specifically sort of working through the corporate governance risks and the political risks in some of the countries you're investing in.
Absolutely. We believe in value. We always say value is prerequisite as opposed to we're value investors. So, you know, like all value-oriented investors, we do get caught in the occasional value trap, but we actually pride ourselves as the, you know, we don't get caught in that many, and that is because, to your question, you know, there is much more to value than a certain metric. So our analysis starts with understanding a business. We view ourselves as appraisers of businesses. Really, that's what I say we do. We appraise businesses, and we wait for the market to have a different view of that business. Appraising a business, it's one thing to know what it might be worth now. More importantly, is sustainability. So we look at supply. We look at demand across the industry. We look at porters' forces. Is it a business where size is important? If so, we tend to gravitate towards the big companies. There's other industries where you don't want the big company with the legacy problems. We want somebody that's nimble. And there are some industries where brand is everything. Others, cost is everything. So we spend a lot of time trying to figure out, is this a business that we want to be an owner of long term? Then we spend a lot of time saying, you know, if this is an asset-heavy business, let's value it on assets. Eventually, we'll make a return on a good asset. So what is the price to book value or the price to liquidation value or the price to replacement value? And look at multiple metrics and try to be very conservative and make sure that we're not buying something that appears to be profitable, but in reality, it's not sustainable. So then we come up with what we think a neutral price is. What do we think is a fair price? Then we say, all right, we've put a lot of work into this, but we want a margin of safety. Many value-oriented investors use 30% or numbers like that. We have no problem with that. But on the one end, if we are going to buy Johnson & Johnson, maybe we'd be happy with a 10% discount. But what could go wrong? Well, let's say they changed their management team, and the new management team tended to be people that like to pay up for acquisitions. So we'd view that as risk. Maybe then we'd want a 30% discount. What if Johnson & Johnson decided to move to China or move to Argentina or move to Russia or places like that? Now there's better chance something goes wrong. So we do a requirement for every stock we have that we have a risk adjustment factor, and we're saying how much of a discount are we going to demand because of management team? How much discount are we going to demand because of corporate governance? How much are we going to demand because of geopolitical risk? How much are we going to demand because of a lot of competition growing pretty quickly? And it leads us to requiring way bigger discounts in certain parts of the world than we have in other. In industries, we tend to generally want bigger discounts for technology and banking and things that are quicker to change and less for more stable businesses. And in terms of countries, Russia in particular, we demand half price before we'll even consider investing in a Russian company. Like I mentioned, we're getting 80%+ discounts and happy to be there now. So that's the approach. A lot of time and effort goes into that, and it does apply to every single stock we buy.
Okay, great. Thank you.
We go next to Jeremy Finger with Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Yes. David, what countries do you see representing the biggest value now, as far as a discount to intrinsic value overall?
Okay, no, thank you. We do see big values, and just quick reminder, we do it all from the bottom up. It's important to be in the right countries, but we've never thought that getting our crystal ball out and deciding that this quarter is going to be good for France and next quarter is going to be good for Australia is not how we do it. What we'll do is each industry analyst is looking for the valuations that make the most sense in their area. And to give you an example of how capital has migrated over the past, and this will eventually get to answering your question too. 3-4 years ago, we were heavily invested in U.S. railroads. They were very cheap as they ran up and up and up. We rolled the money into Japan, where the railroads in Japan got very, very cheap because of the Fukushima disaster. The last year, they ran up a lot, and the money migrated into a railroad in China, Hong Kong, which is trading at less than book value now. Healthcare, back when people were really worried about Obamacare, we were able to buy Eli Lilly as our largest holding. We had a lot of Pfizer and Aetna. A couple of years ago, we sold those and rolled into mostly Central Europe. And last year, we rolled into Hong Kong, China, bought a company there. Telecom, 3-4 years ago, we had, say, a Canadian phone company. A year and a half ago, AT&T in Japan was very cheap. Now we own the biggest phone company in China. We own the biggest in Turkey, the emerging markets. And agriculture, we used to have a lot of tractors and fertilizer and those sort of things. Now we have publicly traded profitable farming companies. And they're in Brazil, Argentina, Ukraine, Indonesia, places like that. Trading, we think, is 10 cents on the dollar. Utilities. We were very happy 3 years ago to own Exelon and Ameren and Idaho Power and some of those things. Now people have really decided they like U.S. utilities because of their bond-like nature. Whereas a year and a half ago, we sold them and we bought utilities in France because people didn't like nuclear power then. So we were able to buy EDF, having fallen from 60 to 13. That is, that's doubled, and we've sold a lot of that. Now we're buying hydroelectric power. We're buying it in Brazil. We're buying it in Russia. The financials, we were able to buy some cheap financials in Japan a year and a half ago. And say, Russia. If we were talking a year and a half ago, we'd be talking about, and the answer to your question would have been Japan. It was 25% of our portfolio in Japan, which was the most we've ever had in a country in our life, excluding the U.S., which has been higher a lot. But right now, we are heavily invested in Canada, mostly because they have some of the world's best uranium miners and some of the world's best gold miners. Gold mining stocks have dropped 80% plus minus in response to a 30% drop in gold. A lot of that was deserved. A lot of it wasn't. And we're buying gold mining companies at less than liquidation value with a free call option on the chance that printing a whole bunch of money might be inflationary. If so, we stand to make a lot of money. If not, I think we still make a little money at this prices. They're very, very cheap. So Canada would be one answer, but that's mining specifically. Russia's a place where in our whole life we haven't much been invested there at all. But as we talked about earlier, across the board in a lot of different sectors, that's very, very cheap. Korea is a place we've been in off and on over the last 15 years, and we're finding opportunity in Korea now. We are finding opportunity in Brazil now. We are finding opportunity in China now. That's a place where we haven't been directly invested very much over the years. Usually we've sold into China through Australian companies or Japanese companies, you name it. And we have, I think, four companies in China now that are very cheap. So Right now, we are finding the most opportunities in the emerging markets we've ever seen. It's roughly 30% of our portfolio. This is the highest it's ever been. Emerging markets, though, keep in mind, isn't really a niche. It's pretty much the whole world. It's 6 billion people out of 7 billion people. It's half the world's economy, most of the world's growth, most of the world's resources. And so with the correction, we've been able to buy really good companies in emerging markets, and so that's an opportunity. The U.S., we continue to think it's a great country with a great companies, but no great stock prices. So I think we're at 12% U.S. now. We were even less than that for a bit. So U.S. is where we're not finding a lot of values. Japan and Europe, we were finding a lot of values a year ago. Now we're finding some values. So we're you know, we do have investments there, and we still see opportunity there. But predominantly, the answer to your question is mining companies and emerging market companies are incredibly cheap.
Perfect. Thank you.
Take our next question from Tim Ferguson with Essex Financial Services. Please go ahead.
Hey, David. Follow-up to the gold question. Maybe if you could touch on your prior firm you were with, prior to you leaving, you also had larger, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but gold mining positions, I believe. And if that was the case back then, what did you see then also that is there, and was there a mistake? And if so, maybe you could talk about that. But also, I'm just curious in terms of the gold mining sector, what are you seeing in terms of changes in management? We always hear that the complaint is that management at gold firms, gold mining firms have been less than stellar, horrible allocators of capital. And maybe explain to all of us what you're seeing that's kind of a dramatic change, whether it be returning cash, you know, just better allocation of capital.
Okay, now that's an excellent question and very appropriate here. Yeah, we started off by saying we don't view the market as being all that efficient. The inefficiency is interesting, though. Second to second, minute to minute, day to day, week to week, month to month, the market's probably pretty efficient. The market, though, is all of us collectively as human beings tend to go to extremes, often generational extremes. And so in 1980, people loved gold. They loved gold. They loved any inflation hedge. They hated stocks. They hated bonds. You could buy bonds at 14% for 30 years or short-term for 22%, and people wanted nothing to do with it. They said, we'll pay, you know, $700 for gold instead, even though it yields nothing and the money supply was dead. And that didn't make sense, and in our view, we're not perpetual gold bugs. As a matter of fact, I spent a lot of the 80s shorting home state mining. Didn't make a lot of sense why mining stocks were trading that expensively. In the 90s, we didn't do a whole lot either. By 2003, we're now 23 years into a bear market of natural resources. People are finally figuring out that maybe financial assets are a pretty good place to be, and pouring into stocks and bonds and selling out of farmland and gold and oil and a lot of other things. And so oil, that had been a third of the index in 1980, became 4% of the index in 2003, and we started buying a lot of it. With the mining, the materials, we did, in fact, all the way back in 2003, go to our maximum 30% in one industry, and that was mining. That was not gold. I think 1% of it was gold. The rest of it was, the market was so bearish on copper that we could buy it at 10 cents a pound. It was trading at 60, and the marginal cost of production was at least $1.20. So owning Phelps-Dodge and owning Freeport, and nickel was very similar. People didn't lie. We were buying Noranda, and we were buying Inco, and we were buying Falcon Bridge, and we bought BVRD, Vale, where we bought very cheap iron in Brazil. We were buying phosphate rock through IMC, which became Mosaic. All we were seeing is the market hated things too much 23 years into a bear market. We were buying things at such a cheap price you didn't even have to assume that the world ever recovered, and we bought it, and fortunately the world recovered immediately, and China and others took off to the moon. And by 4.5 years later, we were buying a lot of gold mining companies that had been left behind, and we sold all the nickel, all the copper, all the iron, all the phosphate, and all that sort of thing. So we were once again still in materials, but in very different materials. We were taking what the market would give us. By late 08, similar to now, the market was giving away small gold mining stocks, and we took them up on that offer, and that worked out very well. Whereas gold stocks lagged everything else in the first half of that decade, gold stocks did really well from 08 to the middle of 2011. And our procedures are to trim. When things go up, it feels good that we have to like them less, and we trim 50 basis points at a time. And so 30% became 29.5, became 29, and by the middle of 2011, we were down from 30% to 14% in mining stocks. Now, with hindsight, I guess zero would have been the right amount, but we still figured we followed our procedures, and we sold most of it, and we still loved the gold stock. We still loved the outlook. The market was agreeing with us, so a lot of the opportunity was good. You know, a lot of it was gone, and we sold into it. Ever since last April, these stocks have come down so much. Before the rally in the first quarter, these things were down 80 to 90%, and we went all the way back up to 25% in gold mining stocks. We like them very much. Now, the second half of your question, good things are better than bad things. We agree with that. But times like 1972 and now, I think people are paying so much for good companies that they're going to turn out to be very bad stocks, that 200% of the good news was put into Coca-Cola stock in 1972, and 200% of the good news was put into Cisco stock in 1999. And we think some of these big consumer and brand name stocks, 200% of the good news have been put in. The other side of it is, we agree with the bad news in Russia. We think that 200% of that bad news is in the price of Russian stocks. And we agree that the management of gold stock companies are bad. As investors in these companies, it drives us crazy, some of the things these companies do in terms of misallocation of capital, hedging at the wrong time, doing acquisitions at the wrong time, buying the wrong things at the wrong time. We agree with that negative. We agree with the negative that the cost of mining will probably keep going up. Mining is expensive business. You move a ton of earth to get 8 grams of gold. And when you've done that, you go to the part of the mine that you only get 6 grams of gold for the same amount of work. And then you go to the part of the mine when you get 4 grams of gold for the same work, and so on. So costs will keep going up. We don't think management's going to get good. Maybe they'll get less bad. You're seeing some positive signs, but we're not assuming it. We are assuming the costs keep getting higher. We are assuming that geopolitical risk keeps getting worse, partly because the friendly places to mine have been mined out, and so the gold is left in less friendly places, and partly because countries are waking up saying, we have a scarce resource, we're not letting you take it for 3% royalty anymore, we want 30% royalty. And so the negatives are there, and we don't like any of them. We think the stock market, once again, has taken 200% of those negatives and embedded them into the stock price. It's not without huge negativity that you can buy a scarce good that has acted as money for thousands of years, that is, doesn't corrode and is divisible and holds up, and for a lot of reasons will continue to be a form of money for hundreds of years to come, to buy something like that with huge optionality, with the printing going on around the world, you would think you would have to pay a huge premium for something with the optionality that gold has, with the quintupling of the Fed's balance sheet and Abenomics in Japan and things like that. We are not paying a huge premium. We're doing the opposite. We are, even after factoring in all those negatives and all the wealth destructions and all the problems, we are buying gold in the ground at cheaper than we can buy it above the ground, adjusted for all the costs, adjusted for the extraction and the capital and the misallocation and everything. So, no, we don't deny the negatives. We think we are more than getting paid for the negatives. So that's a view on a very important subject.
Thank you.
We go next to Sachin Mistry with Lindbrook Capital.
Yeah, hi, David. Thank you for all the insight. I wanted to just understand your sense of valuation of companies that you are finding in emerging economies. I mean, you give good examples of how cheap companies are in Russia. So if you could kind of quantify a little bit on the cheapness of consumer companies you are finding in here.
Okay. Whether it's emerging markets or developed markets, we try to do several things. We try to look at lots of different metrics because, say, price to earnings might be helpful looking at Microsoft, where price to book doesn't matter at all for Microsoft, and price to earnings might not matter at all for Caterpillar because it's cyclical, and so maybe we want to use scenario analysis there. We'll use for consumer companies a lot of times PE combined with enterprise value to sales combined with scenario analysis. And so asset values, what is the value of the assets, plus the return on that asset turning into PEs and price to cash flows. So we find it very helpful to look at different metrics and industry-specific metrics. And then when it comes to emerging markets, we do the additional step of risk adjusting it and wanting a lower PE or a lower price of liquidation value and that sort of thing. And then to consumers, it's a little bit of what I was talking about earlier, whether it's the U.S. or Europe or emerging markets, this huge bifurcation in, say, India. The companies that sell fast food or apparel or things like that in India are extremely expensive. At the same time, they're giving away infrastructure companies and coal companies and cement companies and that sort of thing. In Russia, almost everything in the country is extremely cheap, yet on the consumer side, retailers like Magnite are in no way cheap. Not that they're outrageous, they're just in no way cheap. So emerging markets or not emerging markets, we find that selling basic goods to the lower middle class and middle class, we can do that for 8x earnings. And selling luxury goods or fast food or things like that are trading way more expensive in emerging markets and in developed markets. So we actually have 0% of our portfolio in consumer discretionary stocks and a huge part of our portfolio in companies that sell food and electricity and fuel and cell phone service. So does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Our next question will come from Brad Alford with Alpha Capital Management. Please go ahead.
Hey, David. Brad Alford. We were an investor at Tradewinds back in 2009 through 2011, so a great run, and thank you for that great performance. One of the things that I noticed back then was the heavy concentration in gold stocks. And then now, fast forward to your new company, you've got a heavy concentration in gold stocks. I think you explained it. It's just a timing issue that you were in gold then and you left gold and you're back in gold stocks again. Is that kind of what I'm getting?
Yeah, that's definitely it. And if you were there through the middle of 11, you can go back and look at your statements. You should see that the holdings fell in half over that time period.
And one of the points you made about gold stocks is that, you know, they counterbalance on what the Fed is doing. I mean, the things that worry me about gold stocks, if you look at GDX, the gold stock ETF, it was down 26 in 08, so, and where gold was actually up about 6, that gold stocks become stocks when the market sells off. Do you worry that you actually own stocks and you don't own physical gold here?
Yeah, absolutely. Physical gold, I'm in the camp that physical gold is money. You know, it's a store of value. It's not an investment. That versus cash, they're means of transaction, stores of value. Cash is a better medium of transaction, and gold always has been and always will be a better store of value. I think gold should be a part of everybody's portfolio, whether it's 2% or 10% or 15%, it's a store of value. Now, let's leave gold for a while. Let's just say for the last 150 years, people can hold cash. And then they can say, I'm willing to take this cash, I'm willing to invest it in a business. And then 1929 was a good time to say, I want to hold cash and I don't want to invest in a business. And 1933 is a good time to say, I want to invest in a business, not hold the cash. And it's again, hold the cash in 1972 and invest it in 1974. Cash versus owning stocks, bonds, real estate. Are you getting a good return? Would I rather hold gold than own a business, especially an incredibly tough business like mining? I would rather hold gold, all other things equal. But, like you mentioned, in 08, gold stocks plunged. And gold went up for the 8th straight year on its way to 12 straight years of going up before the last 2.5 year correction. And late 2008, with gold rebounding and already about to put in its 8th straight up year, the GDX, like you say, was down pretty good. The DGXJ, the small gold stocks, were down big. We were buying a lot of companies were down 80-90%. We're not exaggerating. So at that point in time, in late 08, would I rather hold gold or would I rather buy gold in the ground and be getting it for, $100, something like that? All of a sudden, it's worth the risk of owning a business. So we, for only the second time in our career, put 25% of our whole portfolio in one industry. That was gold mining stocks. We did similar with technology in the summer of 02. They were trading below cash. But as they came rebounding up strongly, we sold a lot of those gold stocks and started migrating into Whole Foods markets and eBay and things like that that were actually cheap at the time. So with the costs escalating, the geopolitical risks and things, then gold's pretty interesting again. But the last 2.5 years... once again, the GDX has fallen way more than gold, and should have fallen more than gold because gold went down and costs went up and geopolitical risk got worse, and Barrick and Kinross and things did stuff that destroyed wealth. But should they have fallen 40% or 50%? I think 85% is too much. And so there again, we do the analysis of what's the enterprise value plus all the CapEx plus all the extraction costs and all the processing costs, and we can liquidate these companies and make a profit. At current prices, I would rather own the businesses that own the gold than own the gold itself. I'm getting more than paid for it. So it's all a risk-reward. And right now, this is one of the more attractive business propositions I've seen. Everybody should own some gold, but gold mining stocks right now are pretty compelling, we believe.
Thank you.
You're next to Lewis Meltzer with Merrill Lynch.
Hi, David.
Hi.
At a recent conference that we had, Rich Bernstein, who used to be our former CIO, who you may or may not know, he highlighted a chart that showed consumer inflation, and invariably, as you know, they're in many of the markets that you're investing in, where they're, certainly high single digit and in certain markets, double digit rates. What are your thoughts on inflation affecting some of those consumer stocks that you're looking at? And that's one question. And then just circling back to Gazprom, which is a stock that basically is trading today at the same price it was back in 2009. What do you think are going to be the catalysts to move what is one of the world's most dominant energy companies higher?
Let's start with the last one. A lot of value-oriented investors will do value with a catalyst. I have nothing against catalysts, but for the most part, with lots and lots of people looking for catalysts, we're generally not going to be the first one to see it. Our whole career, we've said valuation will be its own catalyst. If we can buy 50 stocks that are all extremely undervalued in our opinion, and 10 of them will work immediately, and 10 work next year, and 10 work the following year, and 5 work in the future, and 15 we're wrong and we lose money on, and that works out pretty well. No one tells us which ones are which, so we just try to buy a diversified portfolio of mispriced businesses. And the catalyst, I don't know, but usually when industry fundamentals are compelling and when price is cheap, things tend to work out better than we thought and sooner than we would have thought. So, I can't tell you the catalyst other than, oh, my God, it's cheap. And when things get very cheap compared to intrinsic value, it's like a rubber band that's ready to snap back. Inflation, I guess I could talk for another hour on that. I won't. But inflation is a fascinating topic. I guess I'm in the camp that thinks if you double the money supply, you've got 100% inflation into discussion. And then the more interesting part of the discussion is what does that mean that you've had inflation? When does it show itself in the system? How does it show itself in the system? If you print a couple $1 trillion and you buy U.S. bonds with them, then I guess it's pretty easy to see that the inflation is in the bond market. And then if you have a great rotation from bonds into art and collectible and stocks and the government's using the money to pay for tuition and health care and stuff, then I guess we shouldn't be shocked to see that prices are doing well in arts and collectibles and tuitions and health care and things like that. Emerging markets, the same thing. They print money, and they buy our bonds and print money to back it, and there's been a lot of money printing going around the world. And the effect has been rising stock prices, rising art prices, rising food prices, rising healthcare prices, rising tuitions. Then the governments come out and the U.S. government says, we think CPI is 1.5, and Europe will say, ours is lower than that, and we think we have deflation, and Japan will come out and say they have deflation, and look at the price of energy and tuition and housing and don't know where they come up with that. China will put out a bunch of numbers for inflation and GDP and you name it, and they're probably nothing close to reality. So we put no credence in the published inflation numbers in any of these countries, including our own. We do believe that in disinflationary environments like the 80s and 90s, it does tend to help consumers companies. It's, if your Kellogg's and the price of corn and cardboard are falling while you're pricing through the increases in the price of cornflakes, that works out well for you. And Kellogg's didn't do as well in the 70s when the price of corn was going up and cornflakes weren't. So inflation, if it does migrate into basic needs, will hurt some of the consumer companies, and the utilities we own probably won't be able to pass through the prices as fast as some other companies would. So it is a potential negative. On the other hand, if you do own farmland and you do own hydroelectric dams and you do own gas wells, you are somewhat protected from inflation. You will be able to pass things out sooner rather than later. You would much rather have that than, well, certainly rather than bonds, but certainly more than most companies that don't have barriers to entry. We think the companies we have tend to have strong barriers to entry, so we think that will help. But the most important thing is when you add it up, we are buying companies with pretty big moats around them that are really cheap. So even if it takes them a while to pass through inflation, they are really cheap. We get way better than bond-like yields with way better protection against inflation. We have a portfolio that should do well without inflation and should do really well with inflation. So without making a bet, I think just ended up with a portfolio we're pretty happy with.
Thank you.
We go next to David Reimer with MZIP. Please go ahead.
Hey, David, thank you for the call. Quick question about the mining sector in general. I know you mentioned copper before. Are you guys looking into silver mining, or is it the byproduct of the gold miners that you own a portfolio? But could you comment on that, please? Thank you.
Certainly. Silver quite often is a byproduct. You know, we think that gold, silver, platinum, all these things are pretty interesting. They're all pretty cheap relative to their cost of production, and they're pretty cheap relative to other things. Prices of oil or prices of men's suits or you name it, they're all pretty interesting. And relative to the change in the money supply over the last 7 or 8 years, they're all very, very interesting. So we don't spend a lot of time deciding whether gold is better or worse than silver versus platinum versus palladium. But we're finding lots of value in gold. Silver quite often is a byproduct, so it is more likely to swing in price. It'll swing in price if the economy picks up. It's used industrial. Gold's not. If supply of gold or copper picks up, usually they end up with silver as a byproduct and just dump it at any price, so that tends to put pressure on silver. So silver quite likely will swing more, but we like it. We do have a silver mining company, and a lot of our gold companies have silver, so we certainly like silver, and we do have an investment in silver, but gold is primarily where we are, and a little bit of platinum.
Once again, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone. Again, a final reminder, that is star 1 to ask a question. We'll get next to David Seawick with Merrill Lynch.
Hi, David. Two questions. First, you obviously have mentioned gold miners a number of times and you've had a number of questions, but I'm curious as to the ones that you own versus the ones that you don't own. So if you could speak to you know, how you and your team selected those. And second, you know, could you contrast for me the difference between your current firm and how you operated at Tradewinds? What's changed? So, thank you.
Okay, sure. Let's start with the second. Yeah, I've been fortunate enough to this is my 33rd year in the business, and been lucky to 14 years at Farmers Insurance, where I was given a lot of opportunity, went out on my own for a while, sold my little firm to NWQ Investment Management, and 4.5 years spun back out of there, and we created Tradewinds, and was very happy with Tradewinds, and added it all up. I was fortunate to be at a lot of great places and really happy with Tradewinds, and when I look it all up, I believe that the philosophy we have makes sense. So the philosophy we have here is exactly the same as what we have had. The process, taking smart people, focusing them on industries and sectors, and putting a lot of time on sustainability, whether it's Porter's Forces or corporate governance or those sort of things, spend a lot of time on that. That hasn't changed. I've been able to bring in some of the people that I was most impressed with at Tradewinds, Annette Vinnig, Annette Farmers Insurance, a great group of people here. So that's the thing I'm saying. So people, philosophy, process. So most everything is the same. One thing, though, I think that's important that I've learned over the years, that stability is a good thing. So I've kept 51% voting control of this, so the chance that it gets sold out from under, that won't happen. So I think stability is a good thing. I think small employee-owned firms, most of the firms I respect out there, many of them are small employee-owned firms, so we have kept this as a small employee-owned firm, 100% owned by the employees. I think that's important. I'm proud that we kept very focused at Tradewinds, and I think we did a good job for people. Here we're even more focused. We just do global. That's all we do. We also just do pooled accounts and large accounts. We want to spend our time on the portfolio and investing, and so we do that. We stayed at a manageable size there. We're going to stay even you know, half of that size at most. We have no intention of becoming 20-some-odd billion-dollar firm. We are going to stay very small in terms of product, in terms of size, in terms of employee-owned, and focus. So mostly this is what you've known over the years, very little change, but those small little changes I do think are very important changes, and we're very happy with the team we have. Let me see, the first question, I already forgot that.
You have a discrete selection of gold mining companies, so, you know, there's some names that one might expect to see that aren't there and some that you wouldn't expect to see that are there, so it's probably a point for discussing.
Yeah, so we like to have our cake and eat it, too, so we don't ever pay for our top-down views. So we want to buy companies that are trading below liquidation value. So with a starting point, then, we're paying for gold in the ground. We like gold. We like the companies that own a bunch of gold. So we tend to have big resources, big reserves. And others will pay up for growth. So some of the companies that are growing faster, people will pay higher prices on. We like the companies. We think they'll be good investments. But one of the great things about gold is it's scarce and they're not finding anymore. In the last 40 years, there's been like one large find out there. They're not finding this. We don't want to pay up for growth. We do, however, we don't want to pay up for optionality. We love getting free optionality. So where some people might be paying for growth, companies that are producing gold faster and faster, we pay for big reserves, long reserves. We think that at these prices, if gold stays at $1,200 forever, we bought them so cheap, we'll make some money. But what if the price of gold goes way higher? The longer life reserves are going to make us the most money. Could gold go higher? Barrick recently shut down a mine they already put $5 billion into. They said we need way higher prices. I know of nobody that's building a big mine at $1,200 gold. The incremental incentive price to bring on any big new mines would be something north of $2,000, we believe. We believe if you look at the store of value, what should an ounce of gold be relative to a barrel of oil, relative to a Brooks Brothers suit or something, relative to other things out there. We think a case can be made that gold should be $500 to $1,000 more. If we ever went to a Bretton Woods sort of agreement, gold should be 3 or 4 times what it's selling at now. If you ever fully back the money supply, you get to very, very high numbers. So let's just say gold's worth somewhere between $1,000 and many thousands of dollars. We want to buy the companies where we are going to make money if gold stays at the bottom of the range, but we want the companies that will make us the most money if gold goes back to 1900 plus minus. So that means big, long-lived reserves. I have a map on my wall here showing the mines throughout history that have had 20 million ounces of gold, 53 of them, so not very many. We own most of them. We own them through big cash-flowing companies like Barrick and Newmont and Newcrest, and we own them through companies that have massive reserves and resources but aren't going to be mining them this year or next year or the year after. We have companies with big reserves in Alaska, another one with a big reserve in Alaska. We have one with a big reserve in Romania. We have one in Mongolia. These have huge optionality, and we're paying nothing for that option. So we like long-life reserves. Others like growth of production. That's the main difference, but we like their companies. We like ours better.
Thank you.
You're next to Peter Robson with CapTrust.
Yes, David, thank you for the call. Question is, you're talking about the valuations of the equity markets in the States. Where do you think fair valuation would be?
The key there is our margins that are roughly double normal sustainable. If they are, I view the market as fair to slightly overvalued. If margins revert to the mean, the market's one of the more expensive markets ever. For margins to stay double normal would require huge barriers to entry. I think in a global world where there's competition from all kinds of countries and the internet makes competition more and technology in general makes competition more and money being printed left and right and interest rates being nothing makes competition more, I think it'll be tough to keep margins high. And then you throw in what it means to have a zero interest rate policy. I think the Japanese have shown us for the last two decades they've had interest rates at zero, and that's a huge drag on margins. Say Coca-Cola, I think their return on equity is 26%, something like that. Big, successful company. We like them. We don't like the stock. Couple billion comes in, hits the bank. They're already investing as much as they can in their business. The bank's paying them zero. You can't sustain 26% ROE having money invested at zero, so they have to get it out of the bank. And do what? Buy bonds at 2 or 3%, buy their stock back, get 4%, buy somebody else, get 5 or 6%, and maybe they can find something to get 10%. They cannot reinvest that money at 26%, or it's going to be harder and harder. In Econ 101, they taught us that the cost of capital and return on capital are going to be arbitraged away till they're equal. In the real world, that might be an exaggeration, but 26% return on capital and 0% cost of capital, that can't be sustained. The market's anywhere from fairly valued in the U.S. to maybe it needs to drop 30, 40, 50%. I'm not making any prediction, and importantly, it's a lot of stocks out there, so we do like SkyWest Airlines, and we do like Newmont, and we do like Peabody Coal. We are finding stuff in the U.S. We just think the big companies are vulnerable to that whole value trap syndrome of margins starting to revert closer to the cost of capital. More importantly, though, let's say the U.S. is fairly valued or even slightly undervalued, so we can make some money in the U.S. We would still much rather be in these unbelievably compelling values that we've talked about earlier in the call. So we love what we're seeing around the globe.
Okay. Thank you.
Next to Peter Pell with CSM Capital.
My question is about your uranium positions. You talked about that a little bit earlier, other than I suspect they are well-priced, but do you have any other thoughts about uranium usage around the world?
Certainly. We we'll have our views on the market, and the market has its views, and we particularly like it when we think the market's predicated on misinformation. So it's one thing if we have a model and they have a different model, but it's quite another thing if the general view is that we've seen the end of nuclear power. You know, Fukushima happened. It was horrible. We wish it hadn't happened. Awful thing. So the Japanese reactors came off the market, and the Germans talked about closing 20-some-odd plants, which presumably they will. And so the decrease in demand is supply can pretty strong, and inventories are kind of high. On the surface, this is an awful business. So then we do research, and the facts seem to be that we've not seen the end of nuclear power, that at the end of the decade there will be 60 more reactors, not less. That's assuming the Germans take theirs off. The Japanese already seem to be bringing them back on. But China alone is building 60 reactors. And then if you throw in Russia, India, Saudi Arabia, others, that should more than offset the Germans. So a growth industry, not a shrinking industry. That's main point one. Point two, why do we have a surplus of uranium? It's not because we're mining too much uranium. For 12 years now, we have consumed more uranium than we've mined. That has not been a problem, partly of reusing spent fuel, but mostly because there's been this great program, megatons to megawatts. Russian bombs have been being turned into fuel. This is a great thing. It made up the difference and then some, and particularly over the last year, the final deliveries were pretty big, even if the Japanese weren't consuming any. So inventories are very high right now. But that program ended. It ended in November. There'll be no more Russian bombs turned to fuel. So inventories are high right now, but they're going to be dropping every month. Yeah, every month. Even the bears on uranium will agree that there's a problem, but the problem's not for 3 or 4 years. So we say 3 years from now, plus or minus a year, we are going to need a big increase in mine supply. That's important because uranium prices have fallen from 137 down to 35. That's a huge drop. The cost of bringing on new mine production, most people seem to agree, is north of $70 a pound. You need a doubling of uranium prices to bring supply. So if uranium, if fundamentals are arguing for a doubling or more in terms of the uranium price, we're not going to worry a whole lot about whether it takes 2 years or 3 years or 4 years for that to happen. We're going to buy uranium now at $35 a pound, and we have done this through various investments, and we think both the fundamentals and the valuations are very attractive and portend good things.
Thank you.
Our final question will come from Ben Kloss with Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Thanks for the call today. I guess just quickly, any additional commentary you could put on the farmland position that you have and unrelated, but natural gas in general?
Certainly. So from the time I was born till now, the population of the world's gone from 3 billion people to more than 7 billion people, probably headed on its way to 8 billion people. The amount of farmland over that time has really not grown. In the developed world, it's shrunk, and it's grown somewhat in the emerging market. So no increase in farmland. And then farmland is of varying quality. Some you can't grow that much, and some places are worried, you know, salt coming in from the ocean and making it tougher. Good farmland is worth way more than it was 50 years ago. There's, you know, less good farmland and way more people, and there's way more money supply, and there's way more growth in parts of the world that can now afford to buy food. It makes sense that the price of farmland has gone up, and some of the best farmland in the whole world is in the U.S. Midwest. And in Iowa, farmland has gone from 2,500 an acre to 7,000 an acre. Some people think that's too high. Some people think it's not. We want, just like with the question on the U.S. stock market, We don't need to have an opinion on that because other places that have great topsoil, that have farms that are pretty equivalent to the U.S. Midwest, are Argentina and Ukraine. For obvious reasons, people are avoiding Argentina and Ukraine. But just like a common thing we've talked about, people are putting too much of the negative news in there. If great farmland is 7,000 in Iowa, should it be 6,000 or 5,000 or 4,000 in these other places? I'll try 2,500 per acre for a company like MHP that's the leading chicken producer and a commercial chicken producer in Europe and happens to own a bunch of farmland and grow their own grain. You're paying 2,500 all the way down to less than 500 per acre for a starter, which is another company that grows grain and seeds and things like that. So, we have farmland in Brazil and Argentina and Indonesia, and these are not raw farmland. These are equity stakes and publicly traded, profitable farming companies that grow book value, that have done well for a lot of years. So, I think 20% of what it costs in Iowa is a pretty good deal and for profitable companies. So, We absolutely find that it's just compelling to be buying some of the great farmland in the world at very cheap prices. That's mainly natural gas. We look at energy, and the market sometimes likes or dislikes coal and sometimes likes or dislikes gas and likes or dislikes hydroelectric, and we sort of migrate. And right now, we're couple of years ago, we owned, say, Chesapeake in the U.S. because people didn't like the problems there. The problems were real. The stock was too cheap. Now they hate Russia. So most of our gas is in Russia, and most of our energy exposure is in uranium and hydroelectric power in addition to Gazprom. So we like to buy cheap, clean electricity at depressed prices, and with Gazprom and with Hydro and with uranium, that's what I think we've been able to do.
Thank you.
All right. Well, just want to thank you all for taking the time, and we do think these are very interesting times in the market, and with interesting times comes lots of opportunity. We're liking what we see, and we certainly appreciate you all taking the time to talk with us.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.